Okay, I'll do, might just have to shuffle when it comes to the quotes. yeah, so this is, I forgot what the exact title is, but the subtitle, subtext, subtitle is, you know, Why Climate is a Class Question. There is a picture of Marx which is very, you know, technocratic, you know, pro-industrial, you know, sort of a, you know, the quintessential driver that, you know, there's a technological fix that industrial capitalism or industrialization is able to, you know, sort of solve, you know, solve anything. I think it's very common, you know, on the left that this is Marx. It's usually associated with a very Eurocentric view of Marx, and you know, there has really nothing much to say about climate, about ecology. I'll come back to that in a tick, but there's one little quote I thought that sort of summed it up, and this is from in the 70s, which I suppose is the last time we saw, you know, sort of the environment and ecology emerge in a, you know, in a very strong political way into the, you know, sort of into the mainstream. but this was sort of a mainstream new left critique at the time, a guy called Steve Weissman. And just a small quote, the next modern-day technocrat or Marxist who simply echoes the 19th century paean to progress should get his foolish mouth shut with a good-sized fistful of organic dirt. And that summed up a lot of the new left attitude to Marx and to, you know, to Marxists at the time. Unfortunately for Steve, there's also about two paragraphs later, which he sort of attributes to Marx about, you know, accumulation is Moses and the prophets, which is a very well-known, you know, sort of quote of Marx, but it's very well-known also that he's talking about capitalism, not about socialism, but Steve was unable to sort of recognise that. But that approach of, you know, sort of stuff someone's mouth full of organic dirt is sort of a, you know, a very hard picture, but nonetheless not you know, sort of unknown, you know, sort of attitude to what Marx had to say about climate and ecology. So what I wanted to first do was sort of to rescue Marx a little bit from that, you know, from that picture. But I think there's probably five or six things which are, you know, sort of commonly attributed to, you know, to Marx or to Marxism. One, that he had very little to say about, you know, sort of about ecology. That any comments that he did make were by and large an aside, and it was just associated with what he generally argued about capitalism. Either that, or it comes from the early Marx. Some of the other philosophical comments are made that the early Marx is a bit like this, a bit soft on things, you know, alienation, you know, human values and that kind of stuff. That was the humanitarian Marx. The later Marx was the, you know, industrialist. The arguments about ecology and so on weren't part of his analysis of capitalism his critique or analysis of capital or mature capitalism. He had nothing to say about nature at all, about the exploitation of nature, certainly associated with an idea that technological fixes and the development of industrial capitalism, certainly the technologies associated with industrial capitalism, were going to solve all the, you know, the problems of humanity. And also perhaps that he's a, you know, the species, which, you know, you get from sort of stronger, you know, sort of elements of the, you know, the environment movement, I guess. But I wanted to do this mostly through quotes. When you actually look at Marx, there is a very, very different kind of picture. I mean, people who have read some of the material, it will strike you in any case. It's not necessarily the thing that you're looking for when you read Marx, but nonetheless, over and over again, there's references to ecology and the environment or whatever. So here's one from Capital Volume 1. Moreover, all progress in capitalistic agriculture is a progress in the art not only of robbing the labourer, but of robbing the soil. All progress in increasing the fertility of the soil for a given time is a progress towards ruining the last sources of that fertility. The more a country starts its development on the foundation of modern industry, like the United States, for example, the more rapid is this process of destruction. Capitalist production therefore develops technology and the combining together of various processes into a social whole only by sapping the original sources of all wealth, the soil and the labourer. That's Capital Volume 1, the mature, you know, sort of the mature Marx. I just have to find my number 2 quote. Okay. This is from Capital Volume 3. From the standpoint of a higher socio-economic formation, the private property of particular individuals in the earth will appear just as absurd as private property of one man in other men. even an entire society, a nation, or all simultaneously existing societies taken together are not the owners of the earth. They are simply its possessors, its beneficiaries, and have to bequeath in it an improved state to succeeding generations as the heads of the good heads of a household. This is from an earlier Marx, I'll read. It's quite long, but I'll read it. Let us not, however, flatter ourselves over much on account of our human conquest over nature. Right, here's the Marx who supposedly is all about the human conquest over nature. So let us not flatter ourselves over much on account of our human conquest over nature. For each such conquest takes its revenge on us. Sounds familiar? Each of them, it is true, has in the first place the consequences on which we counted, but in the second and third places it has quite different, unforeseen effects, which only too often cancel out the first. The people who in Mesopotamia, Greece, Asia Minor and elsewhere destroyed the forests to obtain cultivable land never dreamed that they were laying the basis for the present devastated condition of these countries by removing along with the forests the collecting centres and the reservoirs of moisture. Anyway, I could go on in the same vein, but you get the idea. I'll just finish. And in fact, with every day that passes, we are learning to understand these laws more correctly, the laws of nature, that is, and getting to know more about the immediate and the more remote consequences of our interference in the traditional course of nature. But the more this happens, the more will men not only feel, but also know their unity with nature, and thus the more impossible will become the senseless and anti-natural idea of a contradiction between mind and matter, man and nature, body and soul. Now I could go on and on by pulling out those kinds of quotes. I'm not going to, probably because I couldn't be able to find them in a hurry if I needed to. But I'm not going to try and go over the whole story, which is told much better by John Bellamy Foster, and which in a thing called Marx's Ecology. In which he goes over a lot, just trying to spell out the deep philosophical connections that the ecological crisis between the ecological crisis and what Marx had to say analysis of capitalism. Bellamy Foster makes a very compelling argument. That one of the reasons that this is true of Marx and Engels was that living at the time. Actually, the rise of capitalism was very much aware of what was happening in terms of the destruction of the environment, the shift from feudal society to capitalist society. That it was a very major picture of the critique of society at the time of what industrial capitalism was doing, both to the society to the natural environment that people were lived in. In fact. There's another quote, which I'm not sure will I try and find. I won't try and find. It's in Capital, in which sort of graphically describes, in two ways, actually, the sewerage in in London. On the one hand, of the enormous waste and what's happening as a consequence of having 3 or 4 million people living in London at the time, but also makes the point, and Bellamy Foster makes the point in itself, that Marx gets a lot of this from other, agricultural scientists and people at the time, that this kind of waste could actually be used to replenish the soil, which is, graphically despoiled. And part of the very early critique that Marx makes is actually part of the critique of British capitalism and British imperialism is that a big feature of imperialism at the time was the British Empire scouring the earth, trying to find phosphates of various kinds in order to replenish the earth, which was being rapidly degraded in Britain. He was at a turning point. Oh, that's another thing I should. Sorry, another two quotes. So the Marxist concern about the environment, concern about the ecology, was like intimately connected with his understanding of capitalism, his analysis of capitalism, and what was happening. Actually, I think I read one of them. Okay, I do. I need a PowerPoint. Yeah. This is number from Engels. and the dialectics of nature. It's again one of the sort of the founding, theoreticians of Marxism. And there's a lot of really good stuff in the dialectics of nature. But here it's going talking about that natural laws and how and what capitalism's done with natural laws. And Engels makes the point again in more than one place that that the development of socialism will require human beings to actually become the masters of nature, but not the masters in terms of quite sure how to put it, not the masters in terms of simply the ultimate control, but of masters in nature in accord with the laws of nature itself, and that socialism would allow society to understand those laws and to be able to control nature and master nature by understanding those laws in a far more deeper way. Okay, I might read all this. As individual capitalists who engage in production and exchange for the sake of immediate profit, only the nearest, most immediate results must first be taken into account. As long as the individual manufacturer or merchant sells a manufacture or purchase commodity with the usual coveted profit, he is satisfied and does not concern himself with what afterwards becomes of the commodity and its purchases. The same thing applies to the natural effects of the same actions. What cared the Spanish planters in Cuba who burned down forests on the slopes of the mountains and obtained from the ashes sufficient fertilizer for one generation of very profitable coffee trees? What cared they that the heavy tropical rainfall afterwards washed away the unprotected upper stratum of the soil, leaving behind only bare rock? In relation to nature as to society, the present mode of production is predominantly concerned only about the immediate, the most tangible result, and then surprise is expressed that the more remote effects of its actions directed to this end turn out to be quite different and mostly quite the opposite in character. Now, that's from a long, long time ago, but as I said, it's you look at what's written there and compare the kinds of arguments about the effects of climate change, what's the CO2 is doing to the environment today, the remote effects of what's the industrial capitalism in this particular case. It's very it's sort of prescient. Okay, so that's as much as I'm going to deal with as far as have a look at the early Marx and see how much embedded in Marx's critique of capitalism is the ideas about ecology and environmental science, and it's really inseparable from an understanding of capitalism. And more than that, it's not just that capitalism is bad, but in terms of the arguments of what can come in its place, I think it's very, very ecologically sound. Having said that, there were I suppose it's also important to make the point, because I'll come back to the question of Malthus. People may be sort of aware of Malthus, who sort of argued that there was population increased geometrically and agriculture only increased arithmetically, and therefore it was a natural law that there was going to be poverty and misery and starvation and famine. And Marx was involved in a huge polemic with Malthus and other Malthusians over the question of famine and whether there was such a natural kind of law. It was really an argument by why poverty and why starvation was a natural thing as opposed to a social thing. And we've got those kinds of arguments with us today. But I wanted to deal, before coming back to that, with if it's true that's what Marx had to say, why are we having to rescue Marx so much from the people who regard maybe not in the terms of the earlier quote, but as the environment movement today is not known for its willingness to quote Marx and understanding about why Marx is important to understanding the environment crisis. I think there are two main reasons. One is what happened to Marxism after the Russian Revolution, and in a nutshell, I'm not going to talk about the degeneration of the revolution, but it is to do with the triumph of Stalinism, where you saw all the kinds of things that were associated with the genuine elements of Marx overturned as Stalin became the mirror image, created industrial capitalism, industrial state capitalism in Russia, and therefore was so concerned simply to industrialise, to catch up to the West, to compete on the same kinds of terms, to build heavy industry. And consequently, any of the elements that were around, even in the early Bolsheviks, in terms of looking at the kinds of agriculture, of creating national parks, conservation, that kind of stuff, was simply dispensed with. And it is it's that picture, not the picture of Marx, but when people actually think of communism or think of Marxism, they think of the huge statues of the proletarian, sort of warrior, or the giant tractors, or that kind of stuff, which were meant to be the picture of the triumph of socialism in Russia, but really were a triumph of mass industrial capital. And there is so many stories of actually horrific environmental degradation that come out of Russia and that whole that whole period. So that's the main reason is the triumph of Stalinism and the extent which Stalinism equated with Marxism, even though it is its opposite. Now, partly if you look at the West, during that period as well, not only the fact that the communist parties reflect that kind of view that there are the triumph of technology and the onward march of the technological progress, but in the so that there's not a, in terms of the Communist Party in the left, there's not a great deal of association between a class analysis and environmental concern. But there is also a growth, I think, in the West of an anti-science, which partly comes out of the actual experience of what that economic progress actually means out of the out of the boom. Now, I'll concentrate on a couple of things, but you can see where the environmental impacts of that boom start to either become register in the consciousness of people who are critical of society, or start to become issues for the capitalist system itself. But there's one overriding thing which worried people back in the 60s and 70s, and we had a similar episode of it in the 80s, and that's the bomb, and the idea that we had societies which had created the bomb. The bomb was sort of the quintessential example of what industrial capitalism had actually presented. There was a serious anti-technology, anti-science component which actually started to grow out of that experience of the post-war boom. So in 1962, although I won't go into Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, which had a huge impact, actually not so much in 1962, but later when it started to resonate much more substantially with the movements that are starting to grow out of the New Left, out of the opposition to the war, ideas about human liberation, emancipation of various kinds, had its spin-offs in some of the environmental movement as well. And Rachel Carson's book, which had been, pilloried by the establishment in 1962, actually starts to become, a major seller. But there are a few. So we've got the bomb. We've got the fact that things like DDT and environmental impacts are actually starting to have an obvious impact on industrialists and on the way capitalism works. In 1967, you had the Torrey Canyon, which is a bit like, I couldn't remember the big one that went down, the big oil tanker that went down in Alaska, Exxon Valdez. It was like an early version of Exxon Valdez, but shocking in terms of the scale of what it actually meant at the time. Here were these super tankers, the triumph of technology and all that kind of stuff. We could spend anything around the world. The Torrey Canyon went down. They ended up having to bomb it to sink it. Near Britain, but had again a huge impact of that. And then you started to get 1972 Blueprint for Survival, 1972 The Limits to Growth. You start to get the environmental, the ecological manifestos that are an echo, partly of the of the 60s and the critique of the 60s, but also echoes of that environmental concern which come out of it. I should have mentioned also 68 was the publication of the population bomb, Paul Ehrlich, and again it had a huge kind of impact. But what is significant, I think, about all, except with Rachel Carson, I'm not going to go into that too much, but the Limits to Growth, the Blueprint for Survival, the population bomb, is that they were the modern variations of Malthusian. The things they were concerned about: population. There was population growth that was that was the problem. It was they didn't put it in those kinds of terms, but that was why you had that's why there were poor. That's why you had crowded slums. There were too many people. The critique wasn't of capitalism, and much of the genuine left critique of that kind of thing at the time And perhaps, I suppose, looking in hindsight, there probably is a little element in which the left actually responded in terms of the capacities of technology to solve those problems of, you know, of power generation or of starvation and so on, and probably less, you know, less concerned about some of the environmental, you know, consequences. But because there was, you know, because the arguments at the time, and the main kind of argument were really, what's the word, apologies, you know, sort of for, you know, for capitalism, and they cut against the weight of the left at the time, which was the criticisms of capitalism. They were seen as justifications for capitalism, not as critiques of capitalism. They also echoed, in some ways, the going down of the movement, how, you know, big chunks of the movement started to drift off into lifestyle, you know, nimbin, you know, hippiedom, that kind of stuff. And there was sort of echoes of that. Actually, you get echoes of it still. Actually, have a look at Monbiot and Vandava Shiva, and people who are ideologues of the anti-capitalist movement. There are aspects of them, and it's what Monbiot's on Heat is very, very good book, but nonetheless the idea that somehow or other the responses, you know, to the environmental crisis or the, you know, the problems with industrial capitalism is to go back to an earlier period of, you know, small production, you know, supposedly much more environmentally sound, more labour intensive. Okay. Okay, I probably said enough about that then. Okay, so I just wanted to go through three things about why we need what Marx, you know, why we need some of what Marx actually has to say, because it's not just a question of sort of rescuing Marx. So I'll just go through quickly. One is the question of the market, and we spent some time last night, and we'll probably spend some other time, other sessions, actually talking about why the market, which is the, you know, quintessential element of, you know, Marx's critique of capitalism and how capitalism actually functions, why the market is unable to solve the questions of the, you know, of climate. Now there are various versions of this, and we came up actually in an earlier session about the world crisis, talking about the Green Revolution. And then if you look, people may not be so familiar with but there was a, you know, in the 70s, there was the idea that, you know, the Green Revolution was going to solve, you know, the world's problems. And there was, you know, investigation of different forms of rice. It's where you start to see high levels of use of fertilizer, of different strands of, responsive, greater production elements of, you know, rice and other foods, use of pesticides and so on. Now, some of the consequences of that we already know, but the impact, at the time, while it was true that food levels went up, it was also true that the application of those technologies were always in the context of the class society in which they were being, you know, they were being applied. So it didn't by any means mean that the, you know, in the Philippines, for example, that the new strains of rice, etc., actually meant, you know, sort of large amounts of rice being distributed across the, across society. Or did it mean the eradication of famine because of the Green Revolution? Because the Green Revolution was about, and about food production more generally, is about growing food as a commodity. They're not growing food for people. They're concerned to grow, you know, sort of food for, you know, as a commodity for profit. And that's why we continue to have a situation where we have more food than what's necessary to feed the world, even in the, you know, given the concerns there is presently about food production, but it's not being distributed. Now, some of the environmental response to this, and we see again as an early echo of the emissions trading scheme, that somehow we can use the market to do something about this. The market can regulate itself, and there was an argument from the environmentalists that we have to externalise the cost. And that if we simply externalise the costs associated with environmental degradation, we would see a proper price placed on everything, and the market then would then work. Now, I'm not going to go into all the arguments about why that's not the case, but you can. I just want to deal with the environmentalists, you know, sort of response and the idea that you can use the market somehow or other to get us out of deal with the question of environmental degradation. Versus Marx. So that argument is still strongly around. I'll use two quick examples to demonstrate some of the stupidity, you know, associated with this. Some Sydney comrades might have heard the story before, but in May last year, there was a company that dumped 300 tons of iron filings off the Galapagos Islands. The reason they were doing this is because increases in iron actually stimulates phytoplankton growth, and phytoplankton sucks in, you know, carbon dioxide. It was going to be a test run for a a massively stupid, when you look at it, idea that somehow we could simply fill the oceans with iron filings, increase massively phytoplankton and suck all this carbon dioxide out of the air. Nonetheless, mad on the one hand, it happened. What is even more bizarre, because of the carbon trading scheme, actually the company was able to sell shares in this thing and trade off the carbon reduction on the carbon trading scheme. Now that's a particularly bizarre example, but the general thing nonetheless applies to the whole way in which the carbon trading schemes actually work. Another example is the clear felling, which is a huge problem in Indonesia, West Papua and other places, to create palm oil plantations. Now again, I won't go into all the details of that, but the idea that you can mow down huge chunks of the rainforest, plant palm oil, they're planting palm oil partly for biofuels. I'll just one little figure. It takes something like 80 to 100 years. I won't get into all the things about the biofuels itself, but even in terms of the carbon that's replaced, people say we can grow the palm oil things and suck in the carbon. 80 to 100 years of the loss of it takes to make up the carbon which is released by the end of those peat bogs. Okay, second thing is internationalism. Because so many times, I think that's what Marx actually brings to bear in terms of analysis of capitalism, that we've actually got a global system. But how many times are we, we often talk about China, India versus Australia, United States, as effectively as us and them. In Australia, we don't talk about, we is not seen in the same kind of way. We don't identify with Rupert Murdoch. When we talk about how electricity prices or increases in electricity prices are going to hit upon us, we're acutely aware of the difference it means between us and the companies or the very, very rich. But very often it's put in terms of, well, look at China. If they want to have standards of living which are like ours, then we're going to see increased carbon. All the power stations, the refrigerators, the cars, all those kinds of things. But I think when you think about it, the we in China and India is just like the we here. Yes, we see massive industrial production in China and India, but who are the benefits for that? The vast majority of the people. We've seen alongside that industrial production, that industrial development, greater and greater levels of inequality. So when we talk about we and we talk about China, we need to think much more, and I think this is something which Marx has actually bring to the environment movement, that we do have to see that internationally. The we in terms of the development and raising the standard of living in the same way that we can use particular kinds of technologies and renewables and all the rest of it that is going to be necessary to maintain a standard of living in a place like Australia is also the kinds of things which can do exactly the same thing in China and India, but which they haven't got access to precisely because their ruling class, like our ruling class, is only interested in production for profit and despoils the environment, despoils the labour in exactly the way Marx describes. But too often we see that with Ghana, or we see with the arguments at the time that somehow or other our standards of living have got something to do with the standards of living in China and not with the standards of living with the people who've got their foot on our neck and on the neck of the Chinese working class. Okay, lastly I wanted to run over three quick things, again, which I think Marxism brings to the environment movement. First, that capitalism didn't mean to create the climate crisis that we've got now. I don't think any of them set out to think, let's see how we can heat up the earth to the point where the polar ice caps melt. They didn't mean to create that. Nonetheless, I hope shown that capitalism and environmental degradation are nonetheless inextricably linked. Capital environment degradation is inextricably linked, and now the question of climate crisis and capitalism are also inextricably linked. If we're going to solve the environment crisis, we have to solve the question of capitalism and what capitalism has done to the environment and the very logic of its growth. Now, this doesn't mean, why I would think sometimes on the left it's actually put, capitalism causes climate change, we need a revolution, we're going to have to change capitalism, get socialism to solve the climate crisis. Now, as true as that may be, in the long run, it doesn't do very much about tomorrow. So I think that I want to just run into two things, and that's going to make the point that there are natural catastrophes. Drought is natural. The rain doesn't come, there's not very much which all the technology in the world can actually can throw at it. But famine is not. Famine is a product of society, is a product of social relations. Hurricanes, cyclones, may be natural. Tsunamis may be natural. We may not be able to do very much about that. But what we saw in New Orleans, or seeing the consequences in Bangladesh or in Burma, are social phenomena, not not natural phenomena. Who dies, how many people die, whether people starve and so on is a social question, not a question of the environment, and therefore the question of how we organise production, how we organise distribution is I think something Marxism brings to the environment movement. Lastly, is how the struggles are actually interlinked, because yes, we need to get rid of capitalism, but if it's simply seen, if we don't understand the way things are interlinked, then I think it can be not an appealing prospect. It seems so huge, so difficult, such a huge kind of task that we're probably better off making spend a bit of time at the beach before the levels rise, or perhaps sitting in Newtown and waiting for the beach to come to us, sipping our coffees. But the struggles they are interlinked, which is one of the things about the privatisation campaign, which I think has not been understood well enough on either on either side. But again, I think we need to encourage that kind of discussion. The question of the neoliberalism and how capitalism actually organises itself in everyday life is inextricably linked with climate change. We're not going to be able to deal with climate change unless power is in public hands. As it remains in private hands, we're not going to be able to, the production for profit is not organise that. Like, we're not going to be able to actually force the renewables, force the building of renewable power stations, as long as the case. If we don't have strong unions, and that doesn't necessarily mean they're fighting around climate change, but if we don't have strong unions, we're not going to have the organised working class, which is actually instrumental to bringing about that kind of change. And that's why there's no China wall between this meeting and the meeting that's happening down there. The defence of Noah Washington, the defence of the CFMU, has to be seen as part of what a climate campaign has to actually take up. And I want to end on that process. If the US is in Afghanistan and Iraq, then we're not going to get the kind of climate change, the action around climate change that we need. That's why the anti-war movement and the climate change campaign are actually inextricably linked. And not just because it's a question of oil in the Middle East, it's a question of whether the United States continues to have the kind of power to dictate around the world. So lastly, I just want to end on that the climate movement therefore must be a movement for social justice. The two things cannot be separated. It's fairly clear to see we can't get social justice without solving the question of climate, and we're not going to build a movement around climate unless it consciously takes up the question of social justice.